Welcome back to Introduction to International Relations. This second optional lecture expands upon our discussion of trust problems, arguing that arms races often result from uncertainty about the other side's intentions. I should say from the outset, though, that this is not the only way to think about arms races. IR scholars often point to this as the quintessential example of a collaboration problem, meaning they tend to assume that there's a clear incentive to build regardless of what the other side is expected to do. I just happen to think that view is too limiting. It probably does fit some examples, but I don't think it fits the one everyone tends to focus on the most, that of the United States and the Soviet Union. Hopefully, by the end of this lecture, you'll understand why, because as you can see from the first slide, the two goals this time around are to revisit our discussion of trust problems, focusing less on trade than on pursuit of military dominance, and to apply the argument to the Cold War. On the second slide, you'll find a game theoretic model that has more in common with the one we use to discuss trust problems than might initially be apparent. I've made a few changes, as trade politics differ in some ways from those of arms races, and that's required me to introduce a new term, yet also allowed me to drop one. And the choices are now build and don't, rather than allow and block. But you'll soon see that the overall dynamics are quite similar. Let's talk a bit more about the setup before we get to that, though. The first thing to note is that I've dropped the beta term, which you'll recall represented the potential benefits of cooperation. Here, we're assuming that cooperation is valuable primarily because it allows states to avoid spending resources on weapons that only really have value if they alter the balance of power, which isn't going to happen if both sides behave the same way. That is, reasonable people can disagree about the optimal level of military spending overall, but even hawks concede that if you double your defense budget and your primary rival does the same, neither of you has achieved anything except accruing a lot of debt or raising taxes or cutting domestic spending or whatever. So we're not going to spend any time in this lecture talking about comparative advantage, differences in energy consumption, and how that might relate to layoffs or anything like that. We are, however, going to introduce costs for building weapons, which must be paid irrespective of the other side's behavior. That is, you'll note that both of player one's payoffs in the bottom row include minus C1, and both of player two's payoffs in the right column include minus C2. Those C terms represent the opportunity cost of devoting resources to amassing weapons when they could instead have been used to invest in infrastructure or human capital, or simply to lower taxes. And again, the benefit of cooperation here isn't one that shows up in the form of a term we add to their payoffs when they do the nice thing, the way beta functioned previously, but rather lies in the fact that neither incurs any costs when that happens. As you've no doubt guessed already, the nice, or less colloquially, cooperative thing here is to not build weapons. Just as allow represented mutual cooperation in the model of trust, we'll refer to don't as mutual cooperation here. The question we're interested in, then, is whether that outcome can be achieved and how the level of trust each side has in the other factors in. The tau terms mean precisely what they did before. They're the temptation to exploit the other side. Exploitation comes in a different form, of course, but it's the same basic idea. and because cooperating with someone who refuses to do the same in return has very different implications in the context of a nuclear arms race than when it comes to trade, we're going to treat those E terms a bit differently as well, though they still mean more or less the same thing. Specifically, we're no longer going to allow them to be both positive and negative. It's pretty clear that when you're locked in an arms race, falling behind is bad. In fact, to simplify the analysis, we're going to assume that the E terms are not only negative, but are less than minus C. That is, we're only trying to apply this model to situations where both sides really believe they're locked in an arms race, and thus the cost of building weapons you don't expect to use, unless something really horrible happens, while undesirable in its own right, is seen as worthwhile by both the blue and red types if you expect the other side to build as well. We are going to have blue and red types again, and they're still going to be differentiated by the size of tau. We're no longer interested in whether tau is greater than or less than beta, though. Here, tau overline, which will appear in red, is, by assumption, larger than C, whereas tau underline, in blue, is not. Let's take a moment to think about what that means. Pretend that we didn't have a trust problem, and everyone knew what type they were dealing with. If both sides were blue, and both sides knew that both sides were blue, would mutual cooperation be stable? Yes, it would be, but only because I just told you that tau underline is less than C. Otherwise, the temptation payoffs would be greater than zero, and even the blue types would have an incentive to unilaterally deviate from the strategy of not building weapons. What about the red types? Well, again, the question is simply whether they'd be willing to settle for that zero when unilaterally deviating promises tau minus C. For the red types, that temptation is too great. So mutual cooperation is going to be possible if both sides are blue, but when both sides are red, it's not. Treating arms races as a collaboration problem, then, is tantamount to assuming that everyone is always the red type. We're going to look at an equilibrium where even the blue types build when the fear of exploitation is unacceptably high, though they'll refrain from doing so if there's more trust. Turn to the next slide so we can analyze that equilibrium. Given that the players don't know who they're dealing with, but, as always, will be able to make an educated guess because they know that the probability of the other side being blue is phi, and the probability of them being red is 1 minus phi, we need to compare the expected utility of building to the expected utility of choosing not to build. We'll do that first for the blue type and then the red. When the blue type chooses not to build, there's a phi probability that they're up against a fellow blue type, and in the equilibrium of interest, that means mutual cooperation will occur, neither side will build, and their payoffs will be zero. So you see that the first part of the left-hand side of the inequality, which reflects the expected utility of not building, is phi times zero. However, choosing not to build also carries some risk of getting exploited, so we've also got 1 minus phi j, the probability of the other player being red, times ei, the exploitation payoff, which is now strictly negative. On the right-hand side, which represents the expected utility of building, we have phi j times tau I underline minus ci, or the temptation payoff for the blue type, less the cost of building, which comes to less than zero, weighted by the likelihood of exploiting player J when choosing to build, plus 1 minus phi J times minus CI, or the value of wasting resources without gaining any advantage, multiplied by the probability that the other side has also chosen to build. If you've been following up until this point, none of that should surprise you. You might even have been able to get there on your own if given more time. The logic of expected utilities should be starting to feel familiar at this point. There's a lot of notation involved, but we're basically doing the same thing every time. Though you may have noticed that we've got a less than sign in that inequality, where there's usually a greater than or equal to sign. That part might have thrown you. It shouldn't, though. Read that bullet point again. It tells us that the blue type will build if and only if that inequality holds. In the lecture on trust problems, the inequality you found on a slide that looks a lot like this one identified when the blue type would allow imports, which was the cooperative strategy in that model, whereas building is the uncooperative strategy here. Why did I write it that way? Well, partly just to save space on the slide. Don't build takes up more room than allow, and partly to avoid confusion. If I said that the blue type doesn't build if and only if some inequality holds, you might wonder whether that means the inequality tells us exactly what they'll do and when, or whether I've simply said that it's not true that the inequality provided on the slide tells us what they'll do and when. Language is tricky. As usual, we can take that ugly inequality and translate it into a much more concise statement. The blue type builds if and only if phi j, their level of trust in the other side, is less than phi hat. Again, the inequality goes the other way, because I'm telling you when they choose the uncooperative strategy. They choose the cooperative one when phi is greater than or equal to phi hat, the same as before. What about the red type? Well, in the interests of time, I won't talk you through that inequality in as much detail. You should be able to figure out why it looks the way it does, though, now that I've explained the one for the blue type, and I'd encourage those of you who are really trying to get the most out of this module to pause for a minute and do so, but after a brief pause to allow you to find the button that'll let you do that, should you so desire, I'm going to continue with the results. Ready? So the red type always wants to build. Again, if you're following the details and remember the substantive story that goes with the notation, that shouldn't be surprising. For red types, arms races are pure collaboration problems. They agree that it's bad for everyone to pour money down the drain without even altering the dynamics of their rivalry, but if the other side chose not to build, they'd absolutely want to gain an advantage over them. They don't just build defensively when they're afraid that the other side's going to do the same. They always build, no matter what, hoping to win the arms race, but aware that they probably won't. So far, I haven't said much that doesn't immediately follow from describing arms races as a trust problem, at least to those of you who understood the lecture on trust problems. Where we're going to get some mileage out of analyzing a new model, or a slight tweak of an existing one at any rate, is by considering what determines the size of phi hat. Before I do that, though, let me just recap for those who are struggling to keep up. I've assumed that player 1 and player 2 are rivals, and they both have the capability to amass more weapons. They're trying to decide whether to actually do so. There's no intrinsic benefit in building weapons, however. The only way for them to be worthwhile is if they alter the balance of power, which presumably allows the more dominant state to achieve objectives it currently cannot. By assumption, there's two types of players. Those who worry a lot about being taken advantage of, but aren't aggressive enough to see much value in coercing others, which we call the blue type, and those who not only want to protect themselves, but are happy to push others around, the nasty red types. The assumptions of the model logically imply that the only time we wouldn't expect weapons to be built is when both sides happen to be blue, which we'd have no way of knowing ourselves as outside observers, and also happen to trust one another sufficiently. What I want to focus on now, for just a few minutes, is what determines that last part. How much trust do they need before they will refrain from building? And then we'll spend the rest of the lecture asking whether we see any evidence that countries in the real world decide whether or not to stockpile weapons in a manner consistent with this argument. So phi hat, as you can see from the slide, is equal to EI plus CI over EI plus tau I. I don't expect the substantive implications of that to jump out at any of you. So let's first plug some numbers in, just to get a sense of what's happening at the mechanical level, then talk about what that means. Suppose that EI was negative 1, meaning that it's really bad to fall behind in the arms race, whereas CI was only 0.25, meaning that it's costly to keep up, but that cost doesn't begin to compare to what happens if you don't. I've already said that what makes the blue type blue is that tau underline is less than C. So let's set that at 0.15. Then phi hat would be equal to negative 0.75 over negative 0.85, where the double negative cancels out, leaving us with 0.75 over 0.85, which is approximately 0.88. That is, if the harm from exploitation was a great deal larger than the cost of building, then the blue type would have to have a very high level of trust in the other side before it would choose not to build. In this case, they'd need to think there was no more than a 12% chance of being exploited. Let's consider what happens when E isn't so large, though, which could either mean that losing the arms race isn't that big a deal, or, simply, that both sides already have so many weapons that laying off for 1 year while your opponent continues to build isn't really going to mean the end of the arms race anyway. They're going to pull ahead, and that's not great, but you've already got such a massive stockpile yourself that you're far from defenseless. Let's set E to negative 0.4 then, keeping C and tau underline where they were before. That would give us negative 0.15 over negative 0.25, which comes to 0.6. Now, the blue types still need a fair amount of trust in one another, but not nearly as much as before. What if the E terms drop a little further to 0.3? Then phi hat also drops to 0.3, meaning that the blue types would be willing to risk falling slightly behind in hopes of proving that there's really no need for an arms race at all, even if they thought that it was more likely than not, by a decent margin, that the other side is red. In other words, intangible qualities such as beliefs about the other side's intentions, which are no easier for us to observe than it is for countries to know for sure who they're up against, though we too can make reasonable guesses, are hugely important to explaining whether an arms race will persist or not, as you'd expect, but so are more concrete and readily observable factors, like how many nukes they've already got. The model is telling us that we should expect to see arms races abate, that's a fancy word for ease up or decrease in strength or intensity, when allowing the other side to expand their arsenal by a certain amount isn't going to alter the balance of power very much anyway. That's something we can evaluate rather easily, and I in fact have done so, focusing on the Cold War. On the next slide, I describe the data I used. I separately analyzed the nuclear stockpiles of the United States and the Soviet Union, later Russia, for the period 1950 to 2001. I start the analysis in 1950 because the Soviet Union tested their first nuclear weapon in 1949, and my independent variables are mostly based on whether the other side has changed its behavior recently. That is, the Cold War is sometimes said to have begun immediately after World War II, but the nuclear arms race doesn't begin until 1949, and so I start my analysis in 1950, which is the first year in which it makes sense to ask how behavior has changed since the start of the arms race. So, for each model, the dependent variable is the number of nuclear warheads. I look at the US and the Soviet Union, or Russia, separately though. When I say separately, I mean that one of the columns in the final slide is going to report the results of a statistical model whose dependent variable was the number of nuclear warheads possessed by the United States in any given year, and one is going to do the same for the USSR or Russia. I am taking the other country's behavior into account in both cases, but only through the independent variables. Specifically, I've got a crude proxy for Phi J, or how trustworthy that country's rival was likely to appear, as well as one for E, or how damaging it would be if the other side continued building while the country in question did not. I don't claim that either of these variables is perfect, only that they capture enough of what matters that if we don't find stockpiles going down when trust is high and the potential harm from exploitation low, that would be bad news for the argument. On the other hand, if we find that both sides cut their arsenals when these crude measures indicate that they probably found their rival more trustworthy and were less worried about exploitation, that would be good news. It wouldn't prove the model right, because no model is right, but it would suggest that it's useful to think of the Cold War as a trust problem rather than a collaboration problem. My measure of trust, which again isn't meant to be perfect and isn't even a probability, starts at zero and goes up any time the other side decreased its nuclear stockpile in the previous year, decreased its overall level of military spending, or ended a long proxy war, such as those fought by the US in Korea and Vietnam, or by the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. The trust measure goes down any time the other side increased its nuclear arsenal, increased its overall military spending sharply by more than 10%, or started a war. My measure of the potential harm from exploitation is simply the difference between the balance of nuclear power currently and what it would be if the other side increased their arsenal by 10% while the country in question did not. Incidentally, I also included some other variables that we're not going to discuss, just to make sure we're getting a fair test of the impact of these variables. Specifically, I also took into account the number of nuclear warheads each country had the year before, which is the very best predictor of how many they'll own in the current year, as well as whatever temporal trends might have been at work for reasons other than those we've already accounted for with the variables we're focusing on. As I said, I'm not even going to discuss these variables, but you should know that I made an effort to rule out third factors, which are always a concern in statistical analysis. On the next slide, you'll find two graphs. These don't allow us to evaluate the implications of the theoretical model directly, but I thought they might be worth including just in case any of you are curious. The graph on the left shows the number of warheads for each country in any given year. You can clearly see that the US had a huge advantage early on, then started cutting back modestly and unevenly for a while, eventually decreasing its arsenal pretty dramatically once the Soviet Union proved that it was willing to do so as well. The Soviet Union takes longer to amass a horrifying number of warheads, but continues building well after the US started showing restraint, reaching a peak of about 40,000 warheads to the US's 30,000. As for the trustworthiness measures, you can see that they're pretty negative early in the Cold War, then slowly move into positive territory, though there's a lot of bouncing around. The US looks slightly more trustworthy overall, particularly in the middle years, but not by much, and distinguishes itself early on by receiving the lowest score possible, if only for 1 year. So we don't see perfect symmetry, either in terms of the number of warheads each side built, or how trustworthy they appeared to be, but it sure looks like the two sides are reacting to one another. The final slide gives us a clearer sense of that. As you can plainly see from the table, I did in fact find that both the US and the Soviet Union, later Russia, tended to decrease their arsenals when the other side had behaved in a manner that should have made them seem more trustworthy, and increased their arsenals when the potential harm from exploitation, as I've chosen to measure it, was greater. Both of these patterns are statistically significant. As ever, we can't know for sure that we're seeing the expected pattern for the reason we expected to find it, but I think this evidence is pretty suggestive. The effects, assuming the patterns really are causal, are fairly substantial too, though I don't want to exaggerate them. For every 1 unit shift on that trustworthiness measure, which, as you saw from the graph, rarely moved by more than 1 unit in a single year, but sometimes did by 2 or occasionally even 3, we expect to see a decrease of about 400 warheads. Doesn't matter which country we're talking about. The results were quite similar in each case, which is also reassuring. That's a pretty big number, but when you consider that the Soviet Union at one point had about 40,000 warheads, you realize that it's not that big. In other words, this analysis indicates that trustworthy behavior encourages one's rival to de-escalate things pretty modestly. Keep that up year after year, and it's possible to escape a tragic situation, but arms races aren't ended overnight. According to this analysis, the potential harm from exploitation has a fairly similar impact, large but not too large, which again suggests that it's possible to break the cycle, but not on a very short time horizon. Only after both sides have already amassed rather large stockpiles can it be said that backing off for 1 year won't force you to fall too far behind. The argument overall suggests that arms races sometimes occur because both sides are trying to get ahead, as the name implies, but can also be driven entirely by the fear of falling behind. That sounds similar, but isn't quite the same. It's both tragic and yet hopeful. It's tragic in the sense that massive amounts of resources are being wasted, and entire generations have to live in fear of a nuclear holocaust, even though mutual cooperation was likely sustainable, though not yet reachable. It's hopeful in the sense that it implies that arms races eventually work themselves out. If both sides really are acting defensively, they'll slowly come to realize that once they feel safe enough to take a few risks and then see that their rival is willing to do the same. If we, as observers of international relations, tried to end arms races prematurely by telling the two sides that they're being reckless, as many did during the Cold War, our words are likely to fall on deaf ears. But we needn't conclude that the only way for such situations to end is for one side to bury the other, which is also something a lot of people said during the Cold War. In fact, while we don't have time to explore it here, there's a strong argument to be made that the Cold War didn't end because the Soviet Union collapsed, but that the Soviet Union collapsed because the Cold War ended. That is, some people think the arms race would have gone on forever if the Soviet economy hadn't imploded. That doesn't strike me as crazy, but we should note that the Soviet Union didn't go down kicking and screaming, but with a whimper. That's not unrelated to the fact that the two sides had finally realized they could place a certain amount of trust in one another. At least, I don't think it is.